Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more digital content, please visit us at lmod.pardes.org. If you miss the seminar this summer, early bird registration is already open for the winter 2019 and summer 2020 seminars. Details can be found online at pardes.org.il/seminar. This session was given by Judy Klitzner as part of the summer 2019 Pardes Executive Learning Seminar on Shaping Meaningful Relationships in a Lonely World.
Good morning, and take two. I want to tell everyone you have done a great mitzvah this morning. Do you know that in the Bible there is actually a mitzvah to get up and walk in the land? We have walked this way and that way. And I am such a firm believer in this, and so many people know this about me, that for my birthday, I received this as a gift. Which I share with you. My kids said, what are you going to do with that? I said, I'm just going to do this. Anyway, okay. All right. Now on to more serious business. Is gender inequality a biblical mandate? Mike, where are you? Are you in this room? Mike and Rebecca? No. Okay, well, let's talk about Mike. Mike, at lunch on Monday, asked me a really difficult question that pervades all of Bible study, and that is, what are we to do with the difficult passages in the Bible? The stories that just don't sit well with us, that seem to rub up against our sense of morality, of relevance, of all kinds of issues. What we're reading in black and white seems to fly in the face of those things that we have now accepted as our ethical world. What do we do? So my quick answer, of course it's a very, very complicated question, but what I was able to tell Mike over lunch was that this is the question that actually motivated the 6 years that I spent writing my book, Subversive Sequels in the Bible. It's exactly about that question. When we read a story, or when we look at a law, and that is difficult to digest, we just can't live with it easily. What I have tried to promote is the notion of the story being a lot larger than it originally appears. Right? Here is a statement in the Bible that disturbs us. But if we realize that statement is part of a much broader conversation on that issue, we begin to understand that the Bible itself appreciates the complexity of that issue. And that while that story or that issue might present itself this way over here, if we open up the conversation, we're going to see that over here, the Bible has a different stand on that. And those different stands are in a kind of dialogue with each other. And sometimes that dialogue is contentious, right? Where you get a sense that these questions are actually being grappled with in a very, very active way. This is, and we talked about this last time, it comes down to, for me, always, the vibrant conversation that is happening in this book. A book is not a stagnant thing. You open it up and it lives and it breathes and it shouts. Right? We know this, right? We look at a piece of, this is not a chumash, yes it is. Mikra Okidolo, it's Tehillim. Okay, fair enough. Right? This much text, the actual text, this much commentary, right? It's alive. It's leaping out at us and it's telling us, this is difficult, we're grappling with it. So we know that the commentators do this, and that they disagree with each other, and that conversation goes on throughout the centuries. But the piece that I want to add here, that's sometimes less understood, is that conversation begins much earlier. It begins within the pages of the Bible itself, right? A position on something, and then a challenging of that position. And then, right, and then the conversation. How do we know, and we talked about this last time, how do we know when passages are in conversation? How do we follow the conversation? What's our tip-off? What are we doing?
Similar language.
We see a story that has this language, and we find another one that seems to pick up that language and spin out the story in a different way. right? And we hold those stories up against one another and see what is the gain when we do that. Besides language, in addition,
images,
themes, plot lines, right? Take a story that's all about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and here's another story that's, well, maybe not all five, but 4 of the 5, and we say, wow, arrows pointing from one to the other. We would be remiss if we didn't draw those stories together and see what we gain from it. To give you a short, really quick example of this, we have till 1:10, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, good, I can read. The Akedah. For me, I will admit, one of the biggest challenges for a teacher of Bible is that the Hebrew calendar year begins in September, around the time of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and the Torah reading on Rosh Hashanah is the Akedah. And everybody expects the teacher to talk about the Akedah. So I'm going to start my class on the Torah and why we should all love Torah by talking about the thing that I will never understand. And it is so disturbing on so many levels that I'd like to leave that to a point where the students actually have a relationship with the Torah. Okay. The Akedah, right, philosophically it's difficult. God demands something of his servant that is, it seems in its essence, absolutely unjust, absolutely immoral. Sacrifice your son. He's done nothing wrong. You've done nothing wrong. And Abraham passes the test, and it seems an essential part of the test is for Abraham to be quiet. Right? He doesn't say a single word of objection to God. What do you mean? That God, don't you think this contradicts everything you've said to me up until now? Not a word from Abraham. Just actions. So we read that story, and we say, oh, that Akedah, that Bible, what an impossible story. Right? Terrible story, terrible book, let's read something else. Or you can notice that at the end of the story of the Akedah, all of a sudden you have this strange epilogue that says, Acharei ha-devarim ha-ele, after these things, Abraham, and it seems like one of the most almost comical anti-climaxes of all time, some messenger comes to Abraham and says, your brother Nahor has had a bunch of grandchildren, and here are their names. And it lists a bunch of names, and that's the end. And you read this and you say, why would you tack this on to this incredibly dramatic, disturbing story? Except then you start reading the names and you see that those names are actually arrows out to another book. The names, just for a sampling, Utz and Buz and Kesed, right? And we think, wait, where have I heard those names before? Well, the book of Job begins with the words, there was a man from the land of Utz, his name was Job. And we have a character who is, the name Booz is picked up there, the Boozite, the man from Booz. And then you start noticing, there are only two characters in the Bible who refer to themselves as Afar Va'efer, dust and ashes. One is Abraham, guess who the other one is?
Job,
good guess. There are only two characters who are called Yirei Elohim, God-fearing. One is Abraham at the Akedah, the other is Job. And so we look at all of this and we say, wow, let's see what else we've got. And trust me when I tell you there's a lot more. And then you realize that not only, right, that the situation is actually quite similar, where a loyal servant of God, somebody who's done nothing wrong, has not one child, but in this case, 10 children who are threatened with death through no wrongdoing of their own. But we notice, I am getting farther away from this thing. Sorry, guys. But what we notice is that the story of Job doesn't just echo the story of the Akedah. It actually, in a very, very subtle yet effective way, challenges its basic assumption that in order to be God's faithful servant, to get that yashar koach at the end of the book, you have to keep your mouth shut. And in fact, the book of Job is 42 chapters, most of which are filled with a just torrent of words on the part of Job saying, I don't deserve this, God. I demand better. This isn't just. And at the end of the book, the friends of Job defend God and say, God is perfect. Whatever God did is right. Job keeps on hammering at God. And at the end of the book, God tells the friends that they have to apologize to Job because he's right and you're wrong. Right? So basically what the story is doing is it's saying, here I am the conversational partner of the Akedah, but not just to have a nice chat with it. I want to shake it up. I want to say it doesn't have to play out that way. That God's world is not only unjust, although sometimes it is, but sometimes we get to say, foul, that's not the way it's supposed to be. And God gives something along the lines, not exactly of an apology, but at least some expression of understanding that sometimes it's really difficult to be a believing human being. Okay, all that is just an example of a difficult story and the gain that we can achieve by viewing the story as part of a larger conversation. I'm going to pause now. Any questions on this? Because the real issue that we're dealing with today, if you thought injustice in the world was a tough one, how about gender inequality? Okay. I'm going to pause for a minute and a half for any comments or criticisms or questions. Okay, let's go. Biblical woman. Ha. Okay. First of all, the first time we meet biblical woman is where?
Garden of Eden.
Garden of Eden. However, we don't meet one biblical woman in the Garden of Eden. We meet three. Okay, the woman is going to be presented to us three times with three different names and three different, I don't know, call it personalities. What are their names? What are her names? Chava, that's going to be number three. Isha, Ha-Isha or Isha. Okay. I don't know how many of you can see this. Chava, Ha-Isha. Actually, this goes first. And the first one is always the hardest to spot. But I'm good. What? Not exactly. Nekeva is a biological description. It's a description, but it's not what she's called. That's also a description. Lilith is a midrashic name. That's a good one, but it's actually not in our book. What? Okay, good. What I'm going to ask you to do is look at source number one on your page and look at the first two parts, and there you will get, all right, here's the answer. This. Ha-Adam. Ha-Adam. Vayivra Elohim et Ha-Adam b'tzalmo b'tzelem Elohim bara oto. God created Ha-Adam in God's image. Next words, Zachar u'nekeva bara oto. God created that Ha-Adam equally male and female. Okay, and that's a big deal that the first creation is male and female. Okay, so My first assignment for you is to read through the little passages here, the Garden of Eden on your page, Ha-Adam, Ha-Isha, and come up with a character sketch of the first two women. We'll get to the third one soon. Okay? Let's take 5 minutes, see what we can do with it. Work! And a special shout out to the people in Orange County. Thank you for joining us. Let us go on. Ha-Adam. Let's try to characterize the female portion of this creature. How would you characterize her? What? Yes, she is created in the image of God, no less than the male portion is created in the image of God. She is created in the image of God. She is God-like in some way. What might that mean? In what way, let me just push that for a moment. In what way, in this passage, might we say that the woman is godlike? What does she do that God has so far done in this book? Or what can she do? God has created lots and lots of things. And now God says to her and to the man, you create. Pru or vu, get out there and take over the world. Populate it. Okay, good. What else? What? Can't hear.
Conquers.
She conquers. And this is something that we might not automatically associate with a biblical woman. She's a conqueror. She is a, not only that, right? She fills the earth, conquers it. Basically, everything that is, well, I'm moving us a little beyond this, but everything that is true for a man, and we wouldn't be surprised if God said, get out and conquer the world, right? What do I do, God? Well, anything there is to do, go do it. right? God is saying the same thing without any distinction to the female as well. Yeah.
Isn't another way of saying that, that actually God's saying to, for you to do it in partnership with your male?
Maybe. We might infer that from this. Not entirely clear, and I would actually argue that the partnership piece is much more pronounced in the second story with the Isha, where God is explicit about that, although things are going to be a little different. But here, I'm not sure. Here, it seems that there is the together element. There is a together element here, which is what? In one way. And Vayomer Lahem, right? God said to them. Everything that God said to the two of them simultaneously, equally. So not only are they God-like, they are both equally the receivers of God's word. Question, or comment. Yeah?
Kind of the obvious question is this a single creature?
Right. And the Midrashim have a field day with this. I don't know. I don't know what this looked like.
Or is this how Adam just meaning man meaning people and two different creatures?
Right.
Or is it a single creature that was
right? Right. So the answer is yes.
It's yeah. It's important because if it is, for instance, a single creature, then it's more modern concept that people have both male and female characteristics.
It's entirely possible that that message is in here, that this is one androgynous creature. Seems to be maybe even the simplest way of understanding it. Yeah?
You know that the English translation,
yes.
Translation is always plural, them, them, them.
Yeah.
But the Hebrew,
yes.
Has plural, plural, which the English has three das and doesn't mention the single.
Say it again? B'tzelem Elohim bara oto. Yeah, I have a lot of dot, dot, dots. That was not an evil plot. That was just saving trees, but yeah. Yes. Well, there is either a him or an it. In it. Yes, agreed. Wait, somebody over here. Yeah.
We were talking about God's instructions to them together.
Yeah.
Not only be fruitful in producing progeny,
mm-hmm.
but to be fruitful of the earth that God produced.
Okay.
The animals, the birds, etc., etc.
Good.
So that's the job, as well as conquering them.
Yep.
That's the job of creating them and nurturing them.
Okay. Although, yeah.
This might be a stretch, but so it says God fashioned the rib that he had taken from the man to the woman.
Oh, you're in the second one now.
Sorry.
You know what, hold the thought for 1 second. Is there any, does anybody, I think we've covered the first person, the Adam. There's a lot more to say about it, but I think we should stop with this. She is creative within the context of every other potential. Is that a fair statement? Okay. Now let's look at the second person, the second woman, the Isha. Yeah, who was talking? Yeah, go.
So,
mm-hmm.
and then brings this entity to the man.
Yes. Notice, by the way, I'm just going to stop you for a second. To whom does Ha'adam refer to in chapter 2?
Well, not clear.
I think it might be not clear, but if it is at all clear, it seems the likeliest reading is what? The man. Because the woman is taken from Ha'adam. So, Vayivieha el Ha'adam. He brought her to the Adam. Now, you might say that Ha'adam is what's ever left, which is why I think you're right. It's not 100% clear, and some people want to make that case. But there, something essential has shifted here. What is it? What? What's shifted? Yeah, this. Okay, yes. Who is at the center of this story?
The man,
right? God brings the woman to the man. Woman is literally derivative of man. He brings her. I didn't put it in here because I thought it might just be too disturbing, but I'll tell you the truth. God brings the animals to him as well. Man, everything is brought to him. he looks at it, he names it, he looks at the woman who was brought to him, and he names her. And then he kind of bursts into this spontaneous song of appreciation. Vayomer ha'adam zot hapam etzem me'atzamai uvasar mibisari lezot yikare isha ki me'ish lukacha zot. Right, this time, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, this one will be called woman, because she was taken from man. And then, who's saying this last piece? Al ken yazov ish et aviv et imo v'davak b'ishto, v'ayu levasaracha. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and leave his wife, and there will be his one flesh. Who's talking here? It's like the narrator sort of stepped back and is talking to us. But what are we noticing here? Everything is a little bit skewed in what way?
Who's paste in the wrong place?
What's that?
He hit paste in the wrong place in the computer.
Ah, okay.
It seems to be like an insert.
Perhaps, yeah. Perhaps that's for a conversation for another time. But the perspective here is what? Yeah.
Well, we're introducing two new concepts: the mother and the wife.
Okay, the mother and the wife. That's all new. We don't. What's a mother? We don't have them yet. Yeah.
It understands the difference between a Rottweiler and a Jewish mother.
A what?
A Rottweiler and a Jewish mother.
Oh, no, Brian. Go ahead.
A Rottweiler eventually lets go.
Okay. Somebody else say Brian. Together. Brian. Okay. Thank you.
So
let us move on. Yes. What are you saying? Yes.
But the reason that they're pointing out the man is that relationship between the Jewish mother and the man, it's very difficult to break, and we're being instructed to say your most important responsibility is to your wife.
Okay, I'm gonna just kind of downgrade the commentary and get to stick with the evidence. First of all, there are no Jews here. These are people. These are prototypical humans. But what you're picking up here is this notion of the relationship between man and woman now is in some way going to supersede the relationship between man and and parents. Not just aviv v'imo, my friend.
Okay.
Yes. Father and mother. Yes.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Oh. Well, I think that I'm going to give God a little bit of humanity.
Okay.
Created one.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good idea.
Okay.
Created two, but they should be as one.
Okay.
Because that's what he really...
Good.
His image was, first one, no, that's not going to work.
Okay.
Two, but they should be as one, always be as one.
Okay. So better to have literally two, figuratively one. Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, I'm sorry, you were saying, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there no reason to read this as she is the core, she takes on the stronger persona, and he is what remains?
I'd love to hear it, yeah.
He is dependent on her still for existence going forward. Huh. The flip side of the reading, I don't know why she's the derivative, and he clings to her, right? Why is
okay, all right, okay, yeah. Did you want to respond to that or something else?
Well, it's related because I'm just looking at the quote, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, this mm-hmm. is me. We've always, the last couple of days, been talking about one is superior, one is inferior, one is subservient.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at this, what I'm saying is, looking in the mirror, this is not somebody separate, this is not someone above or below me, this is me.
Okay. All right. I'm not here to decide what is the there is no one reading of this text. I think what you're all seeing in there is there, and you can make a case for it. What I can tell you what I'm seeing in there is two things. I'm seeing that. I'm seeing relationship for the first time, that which I didn't see any evidence of in chapter one. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see any evidence of it in chapter one. I saw two people who are created in whatever configuration. They are equal to one another. They're equal before God. But we're not really told how they interact with one another. Here we have a sense of connection, of appreciation. Yet, at the same time, we don't have, they're not equally, they don't have necessarily an equal role, equal potential. And the piece that I, nobody mentioned, but I think we have to pay attention to here, is the fact that we're given one perspective, and it's not hers, right? He is rapturous when she is created, and he sings a song. What is she feeling? I don't know. Will a man leave his father and his mother and cling to his woman? Well, is she going to want to leave her father and her mother and cling to her man? He is going to be Ezer. He's going to look at her as Ezer Kinegdo. It's not on your page, but we all know it. The helper opposite him. Is she going to be a helper opposite? Is he going to be an helper opposite her? It seems that somehow from this right, parallel human being that is all this equal, we've begun to see something a little bit
unequal.
There's a differential here, but together with that, there comes a sense of appreciation and perhaps even connection that we didn't see earlier. Now, I don't want to overplay this. I want to leave it as an open question. I know there's a lot more to see here, but I want to really get to the real problem, and that is going to be here. And in between Ha'isha and Chava, what we have is, well, we learned on Monday that we can't call it a sin because the word sin is never used. However, we can call it an act of disobedience. And here, there is one rule that they are given, and that is one negative rule, which is not to eat from this fruit, yet they eat from it anyway. And I'm reading on your sources, starting from the words eating the fruit in bold. Are you with me? Vatera ha'isha ki tov ha'etz lema'achal. The woman saw that the tree was good for eating. V'chita'avahu le'enayim. It was a delight to the eyes. Okay, we're given the reasons for her defying God's command. And what would you say? What is that reason?
Irresistible.
It's just following. She is lusting after it. She knows it is forbidden, but she sees it. And seeing here is going to be a very important word. She sees it. She desires it. There's a feeling of, I've got to have it. Putting aside all of the negative, all the warnings. Vatikach mi piryo vatocha. And she took from its fruit and ate from it. And I want to put these two words up here, seeing and taking, because this is going to become a literary convention in the Bible, throughout the Bible. For people seeing things that they want, that they lust after, they know that is not theirs to take, but they take it anyway. Anybody think of another example of this? What? I can't hear. The Shema. Seeing and taking? I have to think about that.
Not straining
into
your eyes.
Oh, Lotaturu. Yeah, not sure the same words are used.
King David.
Yes! King David and Bathsheba, right? Here is a person who is not yours to take. She's married, and first he ascertains that. And then he says, well, I'm taking her anyway. We have the same words used in the rape of Dinah. We have the same words used when Judah sees and takes a Canaanite woman, right? One rule in the family of the forefathers and foremothers, do not marry a Canaanite woman, but he sees one and he says, that's it, I've got it. That's where I'm going. Right? It's where people don't think, but they move with impulse. And here, this is the first time it happens. She looks at it. It's so alluring. It's just too overwhelmingly beautiful. And so she takes it anyway. And then, hold on one second, and then she gives her husband, he eats it, and now God enters the picture, and God says, Ma zot asit. What is this that you have done?
But only after he asks Adam first.
Yes. Yes, true. Okay, and we're not going to cover all of this. And then God says, and again, the dot, dot, dots, and I apologize for all of it, but they're going to keep coming. Be'etzev teldi banim, God says to this woman, and here comes the real hit. This is where things get exceedingly painful for any reader. Ve'el ishech teshukatech ve'hu yimshol bach. To your man, to your husband, is your desire, and he shall rule over you. Ouch! Okay, what are we supposed to do with this? And now, on the heels of that, Vayikra ha'adam shem ishto Chava. The man called the name of his wife Chava. Ki hi ha'ita em kol chai. She was the mother of all the living. Okay, what happened here? We start with ha'adam where we have equality. We end with what? Subservience, not just inequality, but subservience. Maybe not a subject-subject relationship, but subject-object. She's going to yearn for him, and he's going to use that as power over her. Everything is, the relationship is broken. He names her, but this is kind of a nice name, right? Em Kol Chai, the mother of all the living. So I would argue that here there is still something very positive going on here, which is an acknowledgement that she has this a miraculous ability to create humanity as the first woman had, Adam. But what's missing?
He's restricted her role.
He's restricted her, okay? He has circumscribed her. You are now this part of what woman initially was, but all of this is gone. Okay? All the context of every other ability, all other potential, isn't part of it, isn't recognized. You are now a mother, and that is a marvelous thing, but that will completely define and limit you. Okay. How do we know that we shouldn't be completely depressed right now? How do we know that this is not a mandate for all times? And you should know, of course you do know that, right? This has been used as a mandate. Of course men should control women, because read the Bible, it tells you that. To your husband is your desire, and he shall rule over you. But I would like, yeah.
But just on that point, it just seems to me, you know, from this reading,
yeah.
It's not so much as a mandate as it is, interestingly, a punishment to her.
Okay.
It's a punishment that she... is made to desire the man.
Okay.
It's not a mandate of
for all times.
Well, or now, but now, or even that you're unequal.
Okay. So I want to extend what you're saying.
The man.
Good. I want to extend what you're saying. Maybe the word punishment. I would like to use the word. It's a description of what is going to be. You did this. You broke something. Okay, and the man is going to the man broke it too, and the man is going to get his consequence. What's the man's consequence? Schwitzing. They're going to get expelled, but he's going to reap bread by the sweat of his brow. Let me ask you a question. As we read through the book of Genesis, what is going to be the primary occupation of the men in this book?
Shepherds.
Shepherds are not sweating. Maybe they are because it's hot, but it's not because they're working hard. I'm sorry, I've never really been a shepherd, so I don't know if they do or not. But I'm picturing, as I said last, right, they're sitting under a tree reading a philosophy book, and they're saying, you know, come on, sheep, or let's move over here, let's take a little walk. But the Schwitz, is that not true at all? I don't know. But the real physical labor is being done by the farmer. But they're not farmers. So... would we step up and say, wait a minute, Jacob, how dare you be a shepherd when there's a mandate in the Garden of Eden saying, by the sweat of your brow shall you eat bread? How do we answer that?
You can do both.
You can. Go ahead.
And they did have bread, so presumably they were working by the sweat of their brow.
So somebody was. But what I would like to argue here is that these are not mandates. These are descriptions about the way that the world is going to look. And it's going to look that way for a really long time. Right? Men are going to have to work really hard to eat. Right? Is it a violation of biblical law to have a computer job? Right? We know that that's absurd. Would we say that it's a violation of biblical law for a woman to have an epidural in childbirth because it says with pain shall you have children? Heavens no. Right? By the same token, when the statement to your husband is your desire and he shall rule over you is a description of the way that the world is going to look for a really, really long time. But I would argue that together with that is an implied call to make it better if you can. If you can invent a computer and stop schwitzing, If you can find a drug that's going to make this woman not have that pain, do it. And if you can find a way to bring society forward and help even out male-female relationships, do it. Yes?
Where do you get that?
I get it from two places. I get it from the book of Genesis itself. The fact that people are not, by their professions, they are not doing what this story told them to do, and it's okay. And from my own sense of logic, that throughout history, this is the way we work.
But it's not out of these passages.
Well, out of these passages, I would add one more piece, and that is the following. And I'm not the first person to say this. This story, these consequences at the end of the story, are not a wish for the way that things are supposed to be. They are an expression of the brokenness of the world in general. We have an ideal, right? A harmonious garden where everybody gets along. People, animals, men, women. And then we have this disobedience, and then we have breakdown. And it's not just the male-female relationship that breaks down. What else breaks down? Man and the land. Man and, yes, people and God. Man and woman. Women and animals, right? The serpent, you're going to step on it. It's going to bite you. You're going to step on it. Everything's been thrown off. Women and their offspring. They're going to cause you pain, right? This is a sign, I think, and you're right, it's not open and shut. It's my understanding of this, is that this story is a story of an unwanted brokenness in the world, and together with that, and I think that's my support for it, is that the book of Genesis and later books move us in a different direction, and that's good. That's how I understand it. Okay.
From the cheap seats.
Got it. Your job is to go over here. Comment next to me. Yes.
Maybe taking a little bit from one of these lines as to not a mandate, no, going against the mandate, and that is the step that Adam took, because when Adam names Hava, mm-hmm. he could have named her something that was less than himself, but he stands up for her.
Okay.
He faces up to God in a little bit of a way, and he names her mother of all living, not just mother of my kids,
mm-hmm.
but mother of mm-hmm. all of living. Mm-hmm. So he pushes that.
Nice. Okay. Good. I'm always in for finding some glimmer of positivity here. Yes.
Remember the fuller text. Does it also say that all women are going to suffer?
No, it doesn't say that. No.
Why
do we even think it?
Assumption that this, that what happens is more than just what God is saying to
right.
To you right. Know, Adam Chava, to
right.
The,
maybe and maybe that's the, maybe that's just the simplest thing to say.
To
or we all did. Or we all did. It seems. I mean, we look at the story and the story feels very foundational. It feels symbolic, prototypical. And so we tend to say this is not just, and the fact that their names are, you know, man, woman. so we say, okay, this must somehow be symbols of all men and all women. But you're right. Why? By what right do we make that? Do we make that assumption?
Into our current conditions,
yeah. Okay. I wanna leave that. Again, there are many things here that I'm not gonna answer definitively. But I do want to get back to the text. The expulsion. Are you with me here on your page? Just before number two, the expulsion. Vayishalchehu. God sends them out of the garden. They can't stay there anymore. This is God's beautiful garden. These people cannot stay there. That is the ultimate consequence. You've got to leave. Okay, now, moving ahead, and we must do this. No, or we will not. Yes. Sorry?
You said send them.
Yes, you're right. You're right. And in a sense, at the end, and this gets back to what you said, there is Ha'adam Oto. There is a conflation of the two of them, and that's certainly something to look into. Why is it that it's both? They're both one again. I beyond the purview of our conversation today, but it's an interesting observation. Okay, as introduction. We've got a long way to go, people. We've got other stories to look at, right? I promised you sequels. And the first one I want to argue is even more disturbing than this one, if you can imagine. It's the story of Abraham going to Egypt because there is a famine in the land, in the promised land. As soon as he gets there, God says, Lech Lecha, get going, go to this land, I'm going to promise you the world. And Abraham gets to this land, and there's no food in it. And so Abraham goes to the land that seems to always have food, which is Egypt. And when he gets to the border, he looks at his wife and he says, uh-oh, I just noticed something. What is it?
You're very
beautiful. And that's a problem. And so Abraham's solution is to claim that Sarah is not his wife, but rather his sister. All right, I'm going to have you look at this, but I just want to give you one word of background before you really have a seriously hard time with this. Now you can just have a regular hard time with it. There might be some defense of Abraham's behavior, maybe, in that he did have a plan, which was if he claimed that Sarah was his sister, that he would be considered the responsible person for her, and that they would have to pay him a lot of money to have her. And then, while they're gathering that money, he will stall for time, get all the food that he needs, and then get out of there. What he didn't count on is that there was one person in Egypt who could afford any price that he demanded, and who was that? Paro. And that might be the surprise in the story, is that Paro steps up and says, whatever, name your price, you've got it. Okay, that would be the most positive read of this. You are by no means bound to read it that way. I'm going to just give one more word of background to this, and that is the dark chords at the beginning of the story. We leave Chava. The last female protagonist is Chava. She is defined and limited as mother. And the one thing we know about Sarah before this story is what? She's barren, she can't have children. So the question that we have to keep in the back of our minds is, what is going to happen to a woman who is defined as mother, who is incapable of having children? Now you can read the story. We are looking at source number 2, and let's take 10 minutes and see how it goes. Okay, as you read, please look for any echoes of the story of the Garden of Eden that we have just discussed.
When Abram says, when they see how beautiful you are, they will kill me and let you live. And if he was just worried about himself, this was about saving himself, he would have just said, they're going to kill me, so I have to say this. But the fact that he says, they'll let you live, means he understands one way or the other, Sarai is going to become one of their wives. That is going to happen, and that their best chance of mutual survival is for him to stay alive so that he can get her out.
Okay, not bad. And there are some commentators, other than Deborah, who say this. And that's the beauty of reading this and coming up with all the things that all those guys did. Great. All right, now we're gonna be a little more negative. And I want to start with your indulgence, by citing a philosopher, a very well-known philosopher anthropologist by the name of Martha Nussbaum. And Martha Nussbaum enumerates the main elements that go into the objectification of a human being. And I'm reading this story, and it's reminding me of those things. And I want to be careful here. I'm not saying that Abraham is objectifying Sarah. I actually think the Egyptians are. And I think Abraham has some culpability in this story. Okay, let's leave it at that. What are her components? And tell me if any of these speak to you in the story that you just read. One of them is denial of autonomy and agency. Where do we see that in the story? Who said everywhere? What? No, but specifically. Go ahead.
Sarah's bought and sold. Sarah's like a sheep in the ox.
Okay, so that, by the way, is another bullet point from Martha Nussbaum. She calls it ownership, where people are treated as property. She seems to be treated like property in bartering and buying and selling. Who's, yeah.
She never speaks.
She never speaks, not once, not one word out of her, even though Abraham says to her, Imrina, say you're my sister. What, does she say it? Is he telling her to be complicit in her own abduction? We don't know. She doesn't say a word. Yeah. By the way, that's another item. We're getting all of them. Silencing. Yes.
She says, please.
Yes.
Living now in Israel and not
here. Okay, fair enough. Yes. Yes.
There's one word of politeness. We don't hear
yes.
it often, but interestingly, I think
yes.
I read a little.
Okay.
Is he not commanding her if he's saying please?
Na is a kind of flexible word. Okay. Sometimes it means please, sometimes it means now. It's not clear from this, but again, I always appreciate the effort to read it in a more positive way. It's entirely possible. Yeah.
The first time the word Isha is mentioned here is mm-hmm. Sarai Ishto.
Yes.
After that, we counted, altogether, Isha is mentioned 10 times.
Yes, it is.
And
well,
Sarai's good. Name, I don't believe, is mentioned after that.
Okay, fantastic. And here, I want to, moving, taking what I was going to say at the end, and I want to just really echo what you said, reinforce it, the word Isha appears 10 times. Look at the irony in that. What is Abraham's claim in this story? She's not my Isha, she's my Achot, she's my sister. And the text is saying, Isha, 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 Isha. And Paro is saying, Hine Ishtecha, here's your wife. He's telling Abraham who this woman really is. Abraham is denying it. Okay, now again, even if he's got all of those reasons for it and all of those thoughts, I believe that there is a subtle critique going on within this text for Abraham's behavior. Okay, that's my understanding of it. Again, the denial of autonomy, she is taken. Abraham makes the decision seemingly on his own to go to Egypt. Is she consulted on this? We don't know. Vatukach, right, that is in the passive. She is taken. Sarah has no power whatsoever here. The bayit plays an important role here, and I want to just get this on the board because it's going to play an important role later. She's taken, what's the bayit? What's the house in this story? What house is she taken to? The house of Paro, and that is a place of danger, that is a place of vulnerability, basically of helplessness. And there's actually, the text is not explicit about what happens there, but we do have a very disturbing sentence spoken by Paro when he says, when he rebukes Abraham, he says, "Va'ekach ota li la'isha." I took her as a wife. What does that mean? I don't know. We don't know what happened in that house, but we have a feeling that it wasn't really great. Yes.
That's what troubles me. And there's never there's the dilemma of Abraham. He says, "You're either my wife or you're my sister." He never puts himself to martyr both of them to say, "Let's martyr ourselves," because I don't want my wife to be taken as a sexual slave to Egypt.
Yeah.
That doesn't come. That to me.
Yeah, I would agree with you that I don't know what the answer would have been,
right.
But I would have liked to see something like that,
yes,
right? Where it's not, okay, so you go there, and let's hope that I can help you. Maybe there was some other way to do it. We don't know. But I think that the fact that there is this subtle right reminder of the Isha, right? And remember what we saw in the garden, v'davak b'ishto, cling to your woman, and he's unclinging to her. I would even add to that when Abraham first leaves in Lech Lecha, he leaves behind his nuclear family, he leaves his brothers and sisters, and now he's sort of talking about Sarah as if she's one of those brothers and sisters that's left somewhere else. Maybe there's some subtle hints here that he could have been a little more clinging to her. Yeah. Yeah.
Adam of the Kaaba.
Go ahead.
Kaaba has all the fogging, and Adam just eats the apple. Here, he does all the fogging, and she does what he tells her to do. And the repercussions are very similar, right? It'll be expelled, and
Yes.
Whatever it is.
Yes.
But there's a role reversal.
Yes.
That seems to follow up that, you know, that he'll be the master of her, and that comes like 2 chapters later.
Good. Good. It's playing out those consequences. We're seeing it in action. To your husband is your desire, and he shall rule over you. Is that what we're seeing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, Libby.
Taking on that, I saw a different parallel.
Yes.
And
first of all, no apple. It's just a fruit. I know we all picture that apple. I don't know where that got started.
And it was taken.
Yeah.
And so in this story,
the substitution.
And she is taken.
Fantastic.
And there's a punishment for that, which is the plague.
The role of the forbidden fruit is played in this story by Sarah. She is the object of beauty, of desire, who is taken even though she isn't to be taken. They see, they take.
Right, and then Pyrrha is punished.
Okay, good. Okay.
And he says, get out of here.
Great.
Go, take whatever I gave you.
Okay.
Get out, take this away from me.
Okay, you've moved us forward in our conversation. I want to talk about these substitutions that we've seen here, and I think that's where the incredible irony and the critique comes in this story, where it's telling its story in a sense again, playing out of those negative consequences, but it's critiquing the perpetuation of those negative consequences. You're treating this woman as if she were a piece of fruit that is defined, and that's another one of Martha Nussbaum's categories, reduction to appearance, right? Objectify a person by saying this person, the sum total of this person is how pleasing they are to my eye. That's what's going on here. She is put in the position of fruit. But we're going to see a few other substitutions too. Yeah, many hands. Let's, okay, I think you were first.
Question.
Yeah.
Okay. God intervenes.
Yikes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sarah's heart.
Yes.
Okay. And teach and rebukes Avraham. Okay. I think God plays.
God does not rebuke Avraham. Who rebukes Avraham?
Abraham.
Okay. Hold it. Wait. I'm sorry to cut off your question, but this is the point. If we have one substitution, which is that the role of the fruit is played by this matriarch, who gets to play the role of God in this story? How crazy is this? Paro, the most evil king that this Bible can present. Paro, he says the words that were said by God. He is the moral judge, the superior of Abraham, who rebukes him. And Abraham is the one who's silenced. He's got nothing to say. Ma zot asita. And who does the expelling in this story? Paro. When I read this story and pay close attention to its language, it's using the language of the garden with this beautiful, ironic twist and saying kind of over the heads of the characters, but directly to us, saying this is not right.
Right. You look at your comeuppance, no matter where it's going to come from.
Yes.
You look at your
comeuppance. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Just something in defense of Abraham.
Good. Yes. Yes.
He doesn't trust in God to protect his life. And then he sees that God does intervene by Pharaoh. And it's a sort of necessary process that he goes to until the occasion where he does trust God.
Okay. Yes, he's going to.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I have a question. So they're told that the wife is to cleave to the husband,
mm-hmm.
but then he makes her violate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what kind of position does that put her in?
Exactly.
She has no agency.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's what we're left with, is a feeling of something's really wrong here. Even if we can think of some legitimate defenses for Abraham's behavior, we're still left with those gnawing questions, which is there had to have been something else here. Yeah.
If you're to use the parallel of Ben Ahan to this story,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Paro is also Chava.
Paro is also Chava. Okay.
Because
he does the taking.
Yes.
Okay.
So if you want to go back
to
the first story, are there any parallels with God and
Chava? Wow. Okay, that's your assignment. I don't know. I don't know. Okay, there's always this, but this is just, I mean, isn't it great how much more there is to know about this? Yes.
So, my question is, in the first place, why did Abram take Sarai with him
right.
on this mission? When he went
and not anticipate that it was a place of danger. Right. All these are all really, really, really important questions. Yeah.
He didn't know it was his first time.
Maybe. Maybe.
In this,
yeah.
This passage, there isn't an explanation since Thoreau is not purposefully.
All right. Let's not lose it now, folks. Come on. We're almost there. Yeah.
In this passage.
Yeah.
Since Thoreau was not purposefully doing something bad.
Yeah.
What is the explanation for why God afflicted his household?
Right.
Plagues? I mean,
right. Well, he does take this woman.
But he thinks
She's a single woman, but yet he's still grabbing her. It's not nice behavior, but you're right. You're right. It seems that it's not so much punishment for Paro as it is salvation for Sarah to get her out of there. You're right, though. Like, what has he done wrong? And the fact is that he gets all, not just the last word with Abraham, he gets all the words. Yeah? Okay. We have miles to go. Let's look really briefly at a story that seems to turn it. Well, everything's turning everything on its head. But here's a story where the objectified person is actually a man. Ha! Huh. Source number 3 is the story of Yosef. And I think just in the interest of time, let's go through it together. Tell me when you hear echoes of what we have seen. The Yosef Hurad Mitzrayma. Source 3, a beautiful man. Joseph was brought down to Egypt. Sarah, right? Abraham brings her to Egypt. He is brought, again, like Sarah, lack of agency, no say in the matter. He is, and it's, I mean, in this sense, it's almost, you know, worse. It's like he's thrown in a pit. He's certainly the ownership, he's bought and sold. Vayikinehu Potiphar, the Potiphar, bought him from the Yishmaelim who took him there. Again, the dot, dot, dot. Sorry, sorry, sorry. Miyad ha-Yishmaelim, from the hand of the Ishmaelites. The hand here is going to be a symbol of what? What's the hand? He's going to be bandied about from hand to hand. Ownership, lack of any kind of agency of his own. Everybody else gets to trade in Joseph, and he has nothing to say or do about it. But then, as time goes on, he's in the house, and here I want to get back to this bayit. The bayit in the story of Sarah was a home in which she had no domain, right? She's completely vulnerable there. And here, when Joseph, and this isn't on your page, when he first gets into this house of Potiphar, he also has no domain. He is at the, you know, the bottom of the food chain in the house. But gradually, he rises to the top, right? Throughout the story of Joseph, wherever he is, no matter how dire, somehow he always finds his way back up. And by the time things, right, as they develop, vayefkidehu al beito, Potiphar is going to appoint him as head of his house. V'cho yeshlo natan biyado. Everything he has, he gives into his hand. So where the hand is a symbol of of powerlessness, suddenly that power shifts into Joseph's hand, even in the most unlikely situation. And then the dark chords in the background, Vayehi Yosef, Yefe Toa, Vife Mare. Oh no, he's beautiful. Why does the text do this seemingly non sequitur here? Because it's going to become relevant for what's going to happen, which is that his looks are going to get him in trouble, just as Sarah's looks got her in trouble. By the way, in the story of Joseph, this exact phrase, v'yefe toar v'yefe mar'eh, is used about one other character, the cows in Pharaoh's dream. Okay, talk about objectifying, or what's the word for animalizing? I don't know. Making a person less than human. Joseph is that objectified character where she looks at him, the boss's wife, who is also very much his superior, she looks at him and she sees an object for her desire. Vatisa eshet adonav et eneha, right? It's all about the eye. She raises her eye, and the text reminds us this is hierarchy, not seduction. Eshet adonav, his master's wife. Vatomer shichva imi, and she utters this command, this two-word command, lie with me. That is not treating another person as a fully empowered human being, as a valuable human being who's created in the image of God, very much the opposite, right? You're here for my gratification, do this. But Joseph, and here I would say we have a very big difference between the story of Sarah and the story of Joseph. Vayima Ein. Anybody laying in this room? Okay, do you want to do it? Please, do it. Thank you. Well done. Okay, there's the most schlepped out trup note that we have to tell you that this is not an easy decision for him. And the Midrashim all suggest that the reason for the schlepped out trup note is because he's fighting with his libido. But I think he's fighting with his conscience and his sense of survival, right? If I do this, I'm dead. If I don't do this, I'm dead, right? What do I do? And he's trying to figure, right? She's issuing a command. If I follow her command, my master will certainly kill me. If I say no to her, she will probably kill me. What we see is that she tries to get in, well, at least jailed, maybe killed. This is a classic no-win situation. And so he hesitates. But then, Vayomer el Eshet Adonav, he stands up, he decides to go with the path of morality. He says, I can't do this. It would be terrible to do it to Potiphar. It would be terrible to do it to God. She keeps after him. Finally, her verbal attacks are escalated to a physical attack. She grabs him. Vayazov bigdo biyada. Now what's in her hand? His garment, but his fate. He lost his power again. She calls the people of the house, and we have this repetition of house. Again, he's lost control of the house. But look what happens at the end of the story, just at the second to last line. Vayikach Adonai Yosef Oto, Joseph's master takes him. Vayitnehu el Beit HaSohar. Here comes a new house, the jailhouse. And you would think that of all the houses where a person has no power, this would be the greatest, right, unempowered house. Yet, Vayitem sar beit hasohar biyad Yosef et kol ha'asirim asher beit hasohar. He ends up controlling the house of jail, and that is put in his hand as well. So the hand, which was his powerlessness, turns into the hand of power, and the house that was the house of powerlessness turns into a house of power, even in the worst situations. What have we got here? We've got a story about a man, not a woman, who is following the model of the story of the objectified woman, but there are some very essential changes here. Mostly, what? What's the biggest difference between the two stories? He says no. He says no, and somehow he survives it. Vayima Ein. Now, it's unlikely that he survived it, and we don't really understand how, but he does. And so that ability to say no, we didn't feel was anywhere in the story of Sarah, that we have the silence. We have complete silence throughout the story. Here, at the critical moment, Joseph finds some kind of a voice, and the end of the story, he's okay. At the end of Sarah's story, we're not sure if she's okay. We don't really know. It seems that something terrible has happened to her. We're not sure. Anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
Even though Joseph sort of got put in jail,
yes,
you neglect to mention that she lied about the truth.
Yes, yes.
She lied.
She uses her power,
yeah, totally,
and her words to frame him.
Yeah.
And that's what ends up getting him thrown into jail. Pretty powerful, yes. So he, but that's what's interesting about his story is these radical shifts in his fortunes, right? He's at the bottom, but somehow he keeps rising back up. The hand, the house, right? Down, up, and the end of the story is up. So what do we do with this story? Why does it use some of the tropes of the earlier story? Why does it go back to some of Martha Nussbaum's categories of objectification? And why do we have this sudden finding of his voice? You know, if I were a lawyer, I wouldn't have asked this, because the rule number one when you're a lawyer is don't ask a question that you don't know the answer to. I don't know the answer to this. I just think it's really interesting that this text puts that out there. Maybe because it could happen to anybody, it could happen to a man. Maybe is this text saying that maybe the story is a little bit different? Maybe somehow a man, you know, has the potential to speak up? I don't know. I'm just looking. Yes.
So one difference that jumps out for me,
yeah,
is I see the commentary that in comparing the text as being a little different, which is that the wife of Potiphar, who is so powerful, as you said, one thing she doesn't have the power to do is to see and to take.
Yes,
and the
text she
doesn't use those words.
Correct. She
doesn't. Right? And that's
yes.
almost like a commentary on the Garden
Maybe.
Of Eden.
Nice.
That that's something
nice.
That's lost by what Ha'isha did, was that women no longer have the power, as powerful as they might be, they cannot see and take any longer.
Wow. Okay. This is why it's good to ask the question. Thank you. Yes.
I really understand what people are saying. The question I have is, is gender inequality a biblical mandate?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this what we're hearing really just a reflection of the times as they were?
Right.
And going back to Abraham, every character of any death in the Torah is incredibly flawed. And we're not really necessarily supposed to follow everything that they do. We're not supposed to get angry quickly the way Moses is. We're not supposed to be like David or Womanizer and everybody.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure where the mandate is coming from to act like these people, other than the stories are a reflection of the status of women.
Right, so I posed that question, and let's face it, my answer to that question is no, of course it's not a biblical mandate. And what I'm trying to just, what I'm trying to demonstrate here is that although it isn't a prescription for the way the world must be, it is a pretty good description of the way that it often is. And it is a good description of the way that it is often throughout the Bible. Okay, now where I'm going with this is that I want to show you, and that's why we have to get moving here, that it also doesn't have to be that way, even in the Bible. Okay, are you ready? Okay, but first, I'm not ready for good news yet. I still have to give you some examples, and this is very much on the heels of your comment. It's not just in the Bible where these are descriptions. It's throughout history. And I just collected a few quotes that I think pick up on many of the themes that we've seen. The last piece that Martha Nussbaum doesn't put into this, but is certainly essential to the continued maltreatment of women, is generalizing. With any downtrodden group, generalizing. If you know one, you know all. Stereotyping. They are the same. And they are defined by us, right? We're the ones who look at them under a microscope and define what they are. And some examples from history. From Vienna in the early 20th century, Sigmund Freud. This is incredible. The man we look to figure out how our minds should work. The great question that has never been answered and which I have not yet been able to answer despite my 30 years of research into the feminine soul is, what does a woman want? Okay, here's our regular people over here. We have the microscopes. And here is this odd thing over there. What does this want? What is it? How do we understand it, right? And the assumption there is that if we can figure out one of them, we can figure out all of them. Okay? Israel in the 21st century, a rabbi, a very esteemed rabbi in a pre-army yeshiva, who says don't expect women to reach great achievements in culture or in intellectual pursuits because they are of mediocre spirituality. All of them. Right? They can. And he was talking about, can they reach a certain point in the army, right? Or in any pursuit, because, here are the people, and here are these others who can't quite do what the rest of us can do. In France, in the 18th century, Napoleon, aim call high. Women are nothing but machines for producing children. My favorite is the 21st century England, this incredible guy named Kevin Myers, who wrote in the Sunday Times in London, there was an expose that the male journalists that worked for the BBC were being paid much more than the female journalists. And up stands Kevin Myers, who explains it to all of us, and he says, well, of course, men tend to be paid more because they work harder, they get sick less frequently, and seldom get pregnant. and they are more ambitious. Okay, so this is something, in answer to your question, it just is. And to say that it's a thing of the past or a sign of the times, not sure. Right? Have we completely taken leave of this? Maybe not. Okay, I did promise you some good news. One last text, and that is, no, it's the next to last text, and that is the book of Esther, source number 4. Okay, the last act of Chavruta today, I would like to ask you to read the little passage here, chapter one, with lots of dot, dot, dots. I had to pare it down to its core.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This session was given as part of the summer 2019 Pardes Executive Learning Seminar on Shaping Meaningful Relationships in a Lonely World. If you missed the seminar this summer, early bird registration is already open for the winter 2019 and summer 2020 seminars. Details can be found online at pardes.org.il/seminar.
We are now in source number four, Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther. And I asked you to look for the motives in the behavior of the three characters in this passage. The first is Achashverosh. And the question that I wanted you to consider is, what is he thinking when he calls upon the Queen Vashti to present herself before a group of drunken officers and show off her beauty? Okay, note in the text, she is to wear her crown. He calls upon Vashti Hamalka, Vashti the queen, to come before the king in wearing the crown. Leharot ha'amim v'hasarim et yofia, ki tovat mar'ehi. Here are terms from our previous stories, to show her beauty because, in fact, she is beautiful. Okay, so we talk about reduction to appearance. Here is somebody who comes from royal stock, and yet the king wants her to come in and present herself as if she were no more than a beauty queen in a pageant. Basically, it seems that really what he's doing through this is diminishing her, mocking the symbol of her power, calling upon her to present herself in this way. And now we have a word that has great resonance. What is her response to this? Vatima'en hamalka Vashti lavo. Okay, first of all, she is not Vashti hamalka, Vashti the queen, as she was when he summoned her. She is now a queen first and Vashti second. The queen, assuming all of her queenly posture, refuses. Now, this word reminds us of the very significant word vayimain that was used in the Joseph story, where he refused the order, the sexual harassment of his employer, of Eshet Potiphar's wife. And Yosef somehow miraculously ended up surviving that refusal. Here we have a queen who also refuses, but she is not going to be able to survive it. She's going to be cast out of this narrative, never to be heard from again. And we know that she, so much so that she's going to be replaced in the search for a new queen. Next we have Memuchan, who is this advisor to the king. And he makes a statement that is stereotyping in several different directions. It is not the king alone that Vashti has done wrong to here, but all the officers of all the nations in all the king's provinces. Basically, what he's doing is first generalizing about men. If this one woman does something that is insulting to this one man, all men are affronted. And then he completes the thought by generalizing and stereotyping all women, right? If this one woman can get away with this, disgracing her husband, that is then all women are going to be able to do that as well. They will not give any respect to their husbands. Okay, so what is he doing here? He's generalizing. He's stereotyping. And one other piece of this is that he is, in some sense, demonizing, right? Look at the argument that he makes. These women are everywhere, right? There's one in every house. There's something dark, ubiquitous, invisible about them. They undermine us from within. As I was taking a good look at this, I realized that there's another argument in the Megillah that is very similar to this that's made about another group of people, and that is Haman's claim against the Jews. And it's interesting that some of the midrashim actually conflate Memuchan and Haman and say they're the same character, and I think they do that because it seems to be the same type of argument that they're making, which is that Jews, like women, are everywhere. We can't identify them, but they're a threat from within. And I have to say, in modern times, first of all, sadly, some of these anti-Semitic tropes have been gaining traction, tragically, certainly in places like Pittsburgh and San Diego. The Jew who is demonized, and so all it's one. If you don't like one Jew, you can hate all Jews. The ADL has actually noted a frequent connection that's made between misogyny and anti-Semitism. Societies that tend toward one often tend toward both. In any case, the Megillah notes both of these phenomena. On just one more word on the meeting point of misogyny and anti-Semitism, I would just give one more word to our anti-woman expert, Kevin Myers of the BBC. After his rant against women and his justification for their being paid less than men, he was asked the follow-up question, well, if women get paid less because they're less competent, why are there two women journalists in the BBC who, in fact, are getting top salaries? Well, luckily for Myers, these two women happen to have been Jewish. And so he's able to generalize and marginalize both. But in this case, the greedy Jew trumps the lazy woman. And here is Kevin Myers again. Jews are not generally noted for their insistence on selling their talent for the lowest possible price. Back to the Megillah and Queen Vashti. Vashti is deposed. The search is on for her replacement. And this time, the king wants to get it right. He is not interested in someone with a master's degree or someone with great personal values. He is looking for two criteria only. The new queen has to be beautiful, and she has to be a virgin. This, of course, is going to be Esther is going to be the one to be chosen for this thing, like Sarai. And this is on your page. Let's find it on your page where it says. Chapter 2. They gathered up all the good-looking virgins. Esther was a good-looking virgin. She is taken, like Sarai, into this dangerous bayit yet again, this place of complete lack of agency on her part. She's completely helpless. Here the text is overt about what happens in that dangerous bayit, in that house. She comes in the evening. She leaves in the morning. And she is in the house of the pilagshim, of the concubines. This is a very tragic situation for Esther. She has no choice other than to go along with it. And as we all know, she is chosen as queen. Okay, I want to move to a summation here with the following. And with this, I would like to ask everybody to skip to the last page or the second to last page of your sources after the chart, which is for you to peruse on your own time. Chapter 4. Basically, what I want to do is summarize the Megillah, the Book of Esther, by looking at it as a book in which we find women at a crossroads. Much of this book is a continuation of the trials that we saw in the story of Sarah and other stories. We have objectification, lack of agency, reduction to appearance, no control of anything, silencing. Esther loses her voice. Yet toward the end, I would argue, there are remarkable signs of subversive activity, of taking this story and turning it around. In the stories of a person with no agency, this becomes a story of a woman with agency. And if you look on your page where it says chapter 4, we find a passage in which Mordechai is commanding Esther to do as he says. He's got a plan to save the Jews. She decides that his plan is not sufficient, and so she turns it around on him and says, no, we're going to do it my way. And she comes up with a very sophisticated plan, a very, very gradual plan to create the circumstances in which she can actually plead for the lives of her people, and that plea will be heard. She tells Mordechai, I want you to get the Jews to fast for me. And the end of this little passage is Vayas kechol asher tzivta alav Esther. Mordechai now does all that Esther commands him. So here is a woman who throughout the book until this point has no voice and no power. All of a sudden is the person who is commanding others to do as she says. In addition to that great change in the book, we have, and if you look just below this, chapters 7 and 8, when she finally reaches the critical moment and she makes her case to Achashverosh, she uses this word, hecherashti. I would have remained silent had circumstances been a certain way. And I think this is a very, very powerful word in this context, where this is a woman who has been silenced for so long, and basically what she's saying is, I am not going to remain silent any longer. It's time now to speak. In addition to this, the third line in that piece, Bayom hahu natan hamelech Achashverosh le'Esther hamalka et Beit Haman. The king gives over to Esther the house of Haman. From the women in these stories who were in this terribly vulnerable bayit, this house in which they were owned, now ownership of the house is given over to Esther. Beit Haman, the household of Haman, now moves over into her control, which reverses completely his control over her. In addition to that, I would just argue perhaps the most striking reversal here on your page, chapter 10. Esther is the one who gets to write the record of all that has happened. And I would suggest that this is really a reversal, radical reversal of a woman who was reduced to appearance, who's defined only by her physical appearance. Here is a woman who is a spiritual, religious leader. V'chtichtov Esther Hamalka, the Queen Esther wrote, she writes the record, and gives it tokef, gives it staying power, gives it authority. She has the authority to bestow that authority on this, to create a new holiday that's going to be upheld throughout Jewish history till this very day. And this passage ends with Ma'amar Esther, the words of Esther, right? This validates all of this. V'nichtav basefer, it's written down. And often people have talked about history as, you know, whoever gets to write it gets to structure it, gets to give the perspective. And often people critique this and say that history is really his story. Well, if that's the case, I think what the Book of Esther is telling us at its conclusion is that this is actually her story. This is the story as told from Esther's point of view. The book is a book of a crossroads that moves us from the patterns of the past, things that were described in the Garden of Eden, but not prescribed. And I think the greatest evidence that they're not prescribed is that this book turns into something very, very different that presents to us the possibilities that are there that are open to women. I would just, to bring this into the present moment, I would say that today our challenges are equally, we're at a crossroads today as well. We've made a great deal of progress, but we also have many, many challenges. And I would say the challenges are obvious. Just read the newspaper on any given day. And we might ask ourselves, what do the Hollywood director, the CEO, the religious leader, the professor, the journalist, what do all these people think that a woman is feeling when he, this powerful figure, forces her or threatens her, intimidates her or exploits her? And I think the sad answer is that that person isn't thinking at all about what that woman is thinking. He's not thinking of her as a full human being, someone who's created in God's image, who is equal to man, who is ha'adam. He's looking at that woman as an object for his own gratification and not as a full subject. And I think that, sadly, this problem has been perpetuated by this rare complicity between modern culture, in which, right, secular culture, women are treated as sex objects in advertising, pornography, And really, unfortunately, often within the religious community, where women are viewed as nothing more than impediments to male purity, as stumbling blocks, women have to cover themselves so that men will, that their purity will not be compromised. And often, too often, in both spheres, the terrible answer that has been found is to remove women from the public sphere rather than to address the core issue, which is how do we all treat each other as fully valuable human beings. Together with all of this, the downside, we also have hope. And I think these stories help point toward hope. The dynamic nature of the story as we've seen it, the twists and the turns and the forward motion, suggests that forward motion is always possible. Tikkun is possible. One story plays off of another in subversive ways, showing that we can challenge inequality, we can challenge objectification, we can combat it, and in the best cases, we can actually overturn it. And I think the challenge is to see those changes happening and that motion happening not just within the pages of the Bible, but also this is the challenge to us in every day of our lives. Having said all of that, does the Bible have its own rejoinder to that terrible statement that we saw at the beginning of our studies today? The hierarchy in the relationship between man and woman, El Ishech Teshukatech, to your husband is your desire, and he shall rule over you. And I want to end with source number 5, where we're going to consult another garden, a garden of harmony, a garden where men and women feel a sense of mutual respect, mutual love. And I think that this garden is a kind of subversive rewriting of the texts that we have seen. The first piece here, Bati Legani Achoti Kala, the beloved woman is called my sister bride, and I think this is a kind of rewriting of the wife-sister story where Sarah's position as wife is denied. She's called a sister. Here what we have is a sister who is kind of reclaiming her as a kala, as a bride. In addition to this, the next piece, Dodi Li Va'ani Lo, my beloved is mine and I am his. Well, this sounds like ownership again, but this is not the kind of ownership that is belittling. This is the kind of ownership that is really all about mutual commitment. We belong to each other in a way that we are committed to one another. And just below this, Ani Ledodi V'alai Teshukato. And here I think what we have is a strong echo with that statement back in Genesis, Elecha Teshukato, your desire is toward your husband. He will use that as a source of power and control over you. And here what we're told is that Teshuka, that desire is used in mutuality, with mutual respect, not to control, but actually to have a beautiful relationship. I will leave you with my prayer that we will all one day soon inhabit that beautifully subversive garden, that place of mutual love and respect, a garden in which all voices are heard equally. And the final source on your page, Hayoshevet Baganim Chaverim Makshivim Lekolech Hashmi'ini. O you who dwell in gardens, a lover is listening. Let me hear your voice. I pray for the day where we will have a garden, a harmonious garden, in which all voices are heard equally.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To download digital content, please visit elmod.pardes.org.